Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Tonight is our question and answer. So this can be virtually any question in the realm of psychology, relationships, mental health, addiction, anything along those lines. It can be from siblings or family and friends. They're always welcome to attend these. And it can also be about siblings and family and friends. And we have some of those questions here this evening. But like I did the last time that I did one of these, I'm going to start doing something a little new where I insert a topic that might not be something that would last an entire 45 minutes or an hour like our usual topics, but something that I could speak on for 5 or 10 minutes, because I think there's rich content that doesn't necessarily demand a full broadcast about it. So like I said, submit questions anytime as we go along. If you're a family or friend, tell us your age, if it's relevant, if you're a child, because sometimes we have children, you know, 10 years old, 8 years old, 12 years old, 14 years old, 10. So also just make sure you include that. That helps me to know how to answer the questions. So the first question I have, pre-submitted question I have, is what can I do to support my sister who is in your program? I think this is the most common question that I get during these. Sometimes I get questions about logistics, like what's their day look like and what do they do in the weather and what do they eat, things like that. But in terms of what people are curious about when they tune into these, it is how can I help and support? And I think there's one simple answer, and then I'll expand on it a little bit. It's the same kind of thing that I talk about with parents all the time, which is get a little bit into your work. That might sound strange to a sibling or a family member, but start listening to the podcasts, maybe read one of the books that are being recommended to the parent or to the client in the program, and start becoming curious about your own work. By far, that's the biggest thing that you can do to support them, because the children that are with us, many of them get to the point in their progress, in their work, where they recognize that their seat in the program, their bed in the program, if you will, was earned by them. They recognize that they've fulfilled the criteria to need to be in a program or to benefit from a program like ours, but they don't like being the project. And this is so simple and fundamental. In fact, we all know what I'm about to say. Inherently, we know this, but the best way to help somebody lower their defenses, to get vulnerable, and that's really what we're all asking people to do, right? We're asking people in our program to talk about the emotional turmoil and pain and fear and hurt and sadness that is underneath the symptom. While there are various techniques and models for therapy, that's virtually one dynamic that all of them have in common. That we talk about our pain, our big T or our little T trauma. So if you can begin to talk and to discover your own little T trauma, if it's that, or big T trauma, if it's that, if you can begin to talk about that, then you're a safer person. If you can have some insights about your own childhood, your own anxiety, dark periods of your life where you may have suffered depression, your own difficulties around self-medicating and whatever that looks like, if you can start to talk about that, then the child that goes to our program, or young adult that goes to our program, is going to feel absolutely safe and supported by you. And again, it's not that you have to eclipse the work that you're doing, but you just are open to it. And if it's not that deep, because it doesn't have to go really deep, just become interested and curious at what they're learning. Ask questions. I think for a lot of people, the instinct is, like in a lot of this work, the instinct is actually the opposite of what is needed. And our instinct usually is to come with some kind of advice or to come with something that we can say that's going to lift up their spirits, that's going to make them feel better. That's not a bad instinct, right? That's not crazy, but it's not what works most often. It's just the opposite. It's not knowing. It's being curious. It's being a student. And like I said, going further, even being vulnerable if you're capable of doing that. That's the way that you're going to best support the client that goes through our program. I say this at the end of every broadcast that I have. I say, thank you for and in behalf of your child. I say this to the parents. Tonight I'll say it to those of you who have family or siblings in the program. Thank you for and in behalf of the clients that's at our program for your willingness to educate yourself and to do your own work. So that's what you can do. Start asking questions, start writing about what you're learning. It can be academic if that's what it is to you. And it can be emotional and deeper if that's what it is to you. But start sharing yourself. Start becoming interested. And avoid lectures, solutions, answers, pep talks. We have to resist most of the work when I'm doing a lot of coaching. We have to resist the temptation, the urge to try to make the other person feel better, to fix the dilemma. And I'll talk about that when I talk about a case study tonight. We have to have the urge to we have to resist the urge to try to fix the problem, to be able to sit with them in it. And that tends to lower the defense, whereas fixing it tends to increase the defense. I want to share with you all a case study in recovery. I was just talking to a new therapist that I'm working with who is really working more as a mentor, a sober companion with a young adult female. And she's spending a lot of time with this young woman. This woman is an opiate addict, really polysubstance addict, really just anything. Opiates is probably the go-to. And I've done a little bit of parent coaching with the parents, and they've come to one of our intensives. And so I reached out as a support to this therapist slash mentor, sober coach, with this young adult woman. And I just said, you know, what can you tell me? How is it going? And that way I can be helpful to the parents because they're anxious, and there's been some relapse and some scary moments throughout this process. So if you can give me more information, I can kind of help them and walk them through it. And partly I was trying to find out if there was something, because this person is a new therapist, if there was something where they might need some coaching and ideas from somebody who has more experience with them. So I just asked the question, and then this woman went into this long description about what she's doing, and I was blown away. She was saying, I've told the client, I'll just call the client Susie for the sake of anonymity. She said, I was talking to Susie, and I was telling her, if you want to go use, just tell me, and we'll talk about it. And we'll just talk through it. And if at the end of our discussion you still want to go use, we're not worse off than we were in the beginning. You were already going to use. And she said several things like, if you have the courage to talk to me, because I'm going to do my very best to practice non-judgment. And if you'll talk to me about it, then I'll consider that an honor that you would trust me. And if you don't want to talk to me about it, just tell me that. And then my reaction will be to wonder about what I'm doing that makes you feel not safe. And then she went on to describe some theory behind it and attachment and wanting to be a resource and stay connected and not wanting the young woman to retreat or hide because of shame. She talked about some of the ways that this young woman was interpreting addiction and recovery principles that she was learning. But I sat there listening and was in awe of this young therapist mentor. And I know a lot of therapists, they post on social media, they share quotes that talk about holding a safe space for somebody, being non-judgmental. I think a lot of people do that. But rarely in my career have I ever heard a therapist describe that idea and then describe an approach that was consistent with that idea perfectly. And I said to her this much. I said, I could not be happier and more excited. And I want you to know, I spend my career thinking about this. I write about it. I go all over the world and teach about this idea that you're doing. And rarely, almost never, do I run into a therapist who understands it and can apply it as well as you're applying it. And she was happy to hear that. And we have some history, so we know each other a little bit. But I wanted to share that with you because that's the best chance that this young woman has. She's already had a couple of relapses where she felt ashamed, where she slipped up, and because she slipped up and was ashamed, she just went to the place of flushing her entire life down the toilet, right? That's what addictive thinking does. That's what shame around addiction does, is you make a mistake, you slip up, and you're now just a screw-up, right? You're now just a complete failure, so you might as well just go out in a ball of flames. But what this therapist is establishing is a connection that is above and beyond that, where the person doesn't have to go away. And it's real connection. And furthermore, it's kind of a reparenting. I talk about this all the time, but that kind of response to a client, to a young person, even to an adult, that kind of response changes people's brains, folks. It changes the way they think about themselves. It diminishes over time and eradicates over time shame. It prevents or reduces the likelihood of somebody alienating themselves, right? Isolating themselves, running away, hiding. You establish something so real that you maintain a connection even during moments of relapse and regression. So I wanted to share that with you because it was so profoundly unique and valuable to have that. And you know, we think about those implications with parenting, right? We think about them because our anxiety as parents is such that oftentimes we can't react to such things without a great deal of fear. We just can't. It's challenging at best and impossible at worst. And so sometimes other people can do that. I'm better with your children than I am with my own children. There would be times when you would be better with my children than I would be with my children. Right? There's a built-in distance that creates a kind of an ease around letting go. Right? We're not so identified with it. We're not so triggered by it. And so, you know, while a fundamental part of our recovery as codependents is to establish ourselves and to establish our boundaries, and that doesn't need to be compromised by this, right? The biggest task when it comes to the other is to provide the safe space. And when a partner in a couple or a parent in a relationship can have the reaction that when somebody is afraid to talk to them, when they have a reaction where they start to question, what might I be doing that makes you feel not safe? I'm on top of the world. Right? I think there's a lot of talk, I've said this before, there's a lot of talk today in self-help about vulnerability, right? That's a very popular concept these days. And it's important, it's valuable, it's part of healing, right? It's part of developing a self. It's necessary for growth. It's wonderful and it's difficult and it's terrifying. What I think is not talked about enough is being that safe container. And the reason it's not talked about enough, because I think it's the more difficult task in a relationship. And because we've conflated our anxiety with the concept of attachment. Like we see our anxious or our fear response, our triggers with our loved ones, we see those, we really do. We see those as evidence of how much love we have. And it's just not true. It's just not the same thing. You can be extraordinarily loving and learn to deal with, to manage, to contain your triggers. You really can. You can love deeply and profoundly as a parent, as a spouse, and do enough work to hold space for somebody even when the circumstances can be frightening or upsetting. And at least I've never met anybody who's perfect at it, but we can grow and we can realize that that's the project And that's what this therapist was demonstrating, this mentor in the case study. Next question. Sometimes with your emphasis on parent work, while you say you are not shaming and blaming, it feels like that is the case. What is the difference between what you are doing and overt shame and parent blame? You know, I've had this question for many years now. And at first, I think I was, I don't know if it's defensive or reactive. I wanted to apologize and backpedal and explain it. And then I've come to realize it's this. It's identifying the dynamic without the layer of shame. Right? Because I've made progress in my life around shame and guilt. Okay? I'm speaking in the first person, literally. This is me. Because I've made progress around shame and guilt, I am more able to see my contribution to the problem. And I'll talk about this. I'll talk about being a numbskull or an idiot or denting my children. I'll talk about it with you. I'll talk about it with my children, with my family. And it's not self-flagellating. And it doesn't exonerate the other person of their ultimate responsibility to live their life and to take care of themselves. It does none of those things. It's just a compassion that I can offer because I've let go of some of the shame of my humanity, of being a person. And so when people respond to me identifying that all parents dent children and that the only thing we have control over is ourselves, and so focusing on that can be helpful and learning to say you're sorry and to be accountable on your side, when people respond to that with guilt and shame, it's not coming from me. I'm with you. I'm more aware of my idiocy now than I was 10 or 20 years ago when I had a lot more shame. And I hope to be better off in the future someday. And accountability on my part as a father and a husband, it doesn't rob me of my boundaries. I don't have to compromise my boundaries to demonstrate that I deserve some kind of punishment or that I owe it. I can still say, here's my boundary, and I know what I've done, and I'm sorry. Right? That's the ideal. I've told the story, but I think this question begs for it to be repeated, which is my mother came up to me and my brother early last year in April after I gave a presentation in Orange County, California, where I'm from. And after giving a talk on parenting, my mother came up to my brother and I, and we were chatting, and she said, I'm beginning to think that maybe I should feel bad for some of the ways that I raised you guys. And I said, it would be really nice for us if you were very aware of the mistakes that you made. I think it would be great for you. But feeling bad is not necessary. In fact, I said, feeling bad, which is just a generic way of talking about guilt and shame, feeling bad is going to get in the way of you developing awareness about the mistakes that you've made. So you can do it if you want. I can't talk you out of it, but I don't need it. Robbie, my brother, he doesn't need it. I spoke for him. But we don't need that. But yeah, it would be a great gift for you to have some insight into how you hurt us. Next question. Why so much energy about intensives? Well, I talk about intensives a lot. They're beginning to fill up more and more. We might have to go to 2 intensives per month because February is full. And if March is not full, it's 1 away from being full. Because it is so immersive, because of the amount of time that you spend, it's a lot like for parents or adults. And by the way, I'll answer this question. About half of our participants are our parents or associated with Evoke, and half of them have nothing to do with Evoke. And they blend perfectly well because everybody's work is the same anyway. I get asked the ages, and the ages are 18 to 80. We actually would go above 80 if we got an applicant above 80 and their health was okay. So virtually any adult to the Finding You, which is our flagship program. But time is on our side. You know, there's something about weekly therapy, and you all know I'm a fan of weekly therapy. I share constantly that I've been in outpatient therapy for somewhere around 30 years, been with my most recent with the therapist I have now for 22 years, right? So I'm a fan of outpatient therapy, but I also have done intensives, which is another reason why I have so much energy about it, because it's a great therapy accelerator. It's a great springboard for people that are new. And it lasts for days and hours, and sessions end. And when you spend a lot of time in such a safe emotional cocoon as an Evoke intensive, you get somewhere farther, deeper than you normally would. You can ask follow-up questions. You can struggle with resistance. You can work yourself through the resistance. You learn as much by watching other people as when you do your own work. You really do. So I have energy because it changes lives. I think I've said lately that I don't go to much couples therapy, hardly ever. I don't know if I've been to couples therapy in 7 or 8 years, but all of my therapy contributes to my marital quality. I go to family therapy sometimes, infrequently, really, comparatively to the individual therapy that I do, but all of my therapy is for my parenting, my children, because it's about me, right? I think family therapy and couples therapy can kind of build some bridges and some language and some ideas that everybody knows, kind of these are the rules, these are the projects in the family. I think that can be helpful to have those moments for sure, but individual therapy is the basis for family therapy and family relationships. I've said this before, Murray Bowen, one of the founders of family therapy. So let me say that this again. Dr. Murray Bowen, one of those that are credited for family systems theory, which is the basis of family therapy, never saw two clients at the same time. Now, he talked about families and relationships and systems. He developed some models that you probably even know about. He's the one that coined the phrase triangulation, if you've heard that. So he looked through the lens of family and family systems and relationships, but he really made it the work of developing the self of the individual. And then out of that, the relationships became, right? They were born, they grew, they sprouted out of that sense of self. And he called that sense of self differentiation. The balance of connectedness and individuality, right? Having both to a greater extent. That's what differentiation is about. So I believe in intensives because of time. I believe it because it augments regular therapy. I believe it because it's so immersive and deep, and you can really get to some history, and you could get to watch other people and learn from other people. I have so much energy because I do it. We pay full price as a program for our therapists and our managers to go to intensives. My children have been to intensives. My wife, I go most every year to one to reconnect. It's just a great way to really peel some layers back and then see what's going on inside. And it creates, I think, for those that are new, it creates a reference point for all of your other work. I have, in my opinion, at least who I've come into contact with, I have the greatest therapist in the world. Right? She's literally a genius. I don't use that word metaphorically. Literally, she's a genius. And the people that I did the intensives with were not near her level of education and talent and awareness. Not even close. But I got what I needed out of it. And I brought that back to her. And even part of my first intensive that didn't go so well because there was a hiccup with it, but I worked through it, I brought that back and used that in therapy and learned from that experience. So I am not just the CEO, as it says in that one hair club commercial, but I am a client. And that's why I have so much energy about it, because I know that it works and I see it. I tell my partner every time, he'll call me after I'm finishing an intensive, and he said, Rick Heiser, our executive director, and he'll say, how did it go? And I'll say, and I mean it, I said, best one ever. Virtually every time I say that, best one ever. Next question. What do I say to my family and friends who don't understand what we are doing with our son? How do I respond to their questions and the implied accusations? You know, one thing you could do is give them some Evoke material, give them the podcast. Don't do the heavy lifting. I think one thing you can do is set a boundary and realize that it's not your job to make them feel okay about it. Kind of let go of that. You know, and that means that, you know, if you're the parent, this is stressful. The things that got you here are stressful. And if family and friends can't be supportive of you, it's okay to set boundaries. I'm not asking you to never talk to them again, but you can set a boundary around what you are and what you aren't willing to talk about. I had one mother that said she finally got to the point with her family where she had to send out a group email because she didn't want to have the same conversation with four or five family members each week about how things were going. I've had people say, I put a boundary where I told my father, or I told my brother-in-law, or I told my sister that I'm not going to talk about this anymore. I'm not going to debate this anymore. You know, part of our work is finding our people. And an obvious place to look for our people are Al-Anon meetings, right? Codependence Anonymous meetings, family Anonymous meetings, Families Anonymous, Refuge Recovery, Evoke Parent Support Groups, right? Those are part of, that's a great place to start to look for your people. I was saying this this Monday in New York City when I was doing the parent support group. I was saying, you know, a lot of you have figured out what it's like to go back to dinner parties and have conversations and hear people talking about things that aren't important. And what you realize sometimes is those aren't your rooms anymore. Those aren't your people. What I found when I've gone through some of my biggest transformations in my own development is that I lost some friends. I also gained some friends, and I kept some friends that were willing to talk and to listen to understand. So while I would like to suggest that you get to keep all the people in your life forever who have been significant in your life, sometimes setting a boundary around them at various levels is part of the work. And sometimes finding new people is part of the work. In my new book, I talk about this in the last chapter, about learning to die over and over again, right? Figuratively die, which means we let go of old ideas, old relationships, old situations, context, beliefs. That's part of it. If we're not doing that, if we arrive at the point where we've learned everything that we need to learn, then we're really dead already. But if we keep learning, keep growing, keep evolving, it's the only way to kind of live a life, right? So I think boundaries, anywhere from what you're willing to talk about, not talk about, inviting them to read Evoke literature, Evoke blogs, listen to the podcast, anything like that. And if they want to be in your life and want to understand, they'll do those things. And if they don't, they just want to criticize you, tell you how you're wrong, beat you up over it, make you feel bad, they won't do those things. Or they might not have to do those things, and just if they're a good listener and ask questions and ask you what you want, you can tell them. That works too, of course. My son talks about his friends with such respect and admiration, someone says, but they were really just his drug friends. How do we help him see this? I've got this question for many years. I would be careful about that line of thinking. I would think of it this way. Ask yourself, what is he getting out of those relationships? Why are they meaningful? Why does he feel safe? And while the bond might be centered around drugs, it doesn't make it all bad. And it doesn't erase the fact that there's a genuine need that he's getting out of those relationships. I have friends at work. I have friends that I golf with, right? That I fish with. So I have friends that we share a sporting interest of watching sports. I have all kinds of friends. And if golf went away or I changed my job, I would lose some friends. Not the closest ones, of course. That didn't mean that they weren't friends. I think we want to paint these negative influences with one brush because they scare us and threaten us. And just like I talked about at the very beginning of the episode this tonight, it might behoove us to kind of go in the opposite direction and to talk about the value in that friendship and see if there are ways to replicate some of the aspects that those friends were showing, like acceptance and understanding and listening and not lecturing or guilting or threatening or whatever it is, right? Children find friends with no expectations because they feel crushed by the expectations in their lives often. And yes, they look for the lowest common denominator, and we have a kind of a negative lens that we look at that through, and that's true. But what are they looking for? They're looking for a place to be okay. That therapist that I talked about at the top of tonight's episode, he was trying to be that kind of friend, but still a positive influence. So I wouldn't reduce even druggy friends to that. And of course, some folks in their lives are negative influences, but why are they seeking out such a negative influence? What are they getting out of it? That's really, a lot of times, the question we ask as therapists over and over again when we're trying to figure out somebody's negative behaviors. What's the benefit? What's the genuine need that's getting met here? All right, I'll take any live questions that have come in, or you can send any in, live questions or comments. The first one says, thanks for the parent support group on Monday. It was a great experience and very comforting. I'm so glad. Somebody asked, do you ever offer parent support groups in Minneapolis, St. Paul? I haven't. I would if there were a large enough group to travel out there. I was just actually there a few hours ago flying through. But if you have a community, somebody, for example, in Southern California, we do meetings there sometimes because we have a lot of clients there, but somebody got together a group of 30, 40 people recently, and I came and spoke. I'm going up to Park City, Utah, where we have very few clients. I went up there 4 times last year, and I'm going up there again in May after my new book comes out, to give a talk there. I just went to Texas and spoke to a large group. I went to Philadelphia. So I'll go places and offer support group and psychoeducation if you have a community and a group of people. So please, I love it. I love speaking. I love outreach. I love teaching people about this stuff. Because some of it's just not common sense. Some of it's so counterintuitive. So I'll go virtually anywhere if we can get a group of people together. So please reach out to me if you think you can do that. Especially after the book comes out, which is on February 24th. I'll be doing a lot of touring. Someone asks, how do you support brothers and sisters who are upset about the behavior of their siblings that led to wilderness therapy? Some brothers and sisters struggle with the behavior that led to wilderness and struggle with forgiveness. You'll hear a theme in my answer to this question. Understand it. In other words, go with it. One of the most effective ways to deal with resistance, a lack of progress, somebody being stuck, is go with the resistance. Sit in the stuckness with them. Validate the fact that they don't want to forgive. See, when a sibling, or anybody for that matter, but in this case, it's the question is about a sibling. When a sibling does things that upset and traumatize the child, and I don't mean it has to be abuse, but create distress, you know, small t trauma. And it might be big T, but let's assume it's just small t. The common thread of trauma in human beings' lives is that they didn't have control. So the siblings who don't want to forgive are trying to exercise control. And if we try to push them toward forgiveness, because we know that that's part of a healthy healing, right? To move through it, we know it's that. Then we're really doing to them what's been done to them before. So we don't press for forgiveness. Forgiveness comes on the terms of the person who's been hurt, not anybody else. So lean into it, go with it. And also understand there's a difference between forgiveness and you don't have to go back to the same boundary until trust is earned. And there's no imperative. I talked about this Monday night in New York. There's no imperative for trust. There's no timeline where you have to trust. You get to not trust. So honoring the siblings in this case and their trauma is really where the healing goes. And it might feel, again, like so much of what I described, it feels counterintuitive and it feels like we're indulging them, right? Or indulging the anger that they have. But I will tell you, what I've learned as a therapist, that's the best way to encourage and facilitate healing and evolution. It's a little bit longer of a game. Doesn't happen quickly. And we kind of have to let go of it for it to be effective. Someone says, you mentioned Monday the idea of parents letting go of our control as a necessary step, but I think I'm misunderstanding. If we as parents send our son to Evoke or therapeutic boarding school, I feel like I'm doing the opposite, exerting total control over my child. Your thoughts about this would help. Thanks. Thank you for the question. I'm going to use a metaphor first, and then I'm going to speak to your question specifically. I'm going to use a sports metaphor, and forgive me if it's not your cup of tea. I could use an art metaphor, but I don't have as much experience with art as I do with sports. And it wasn't like I was a gifted athlete. I was just a normal kid. And I played Little League Baseball, played tennis. When I would get nervous or have a few bad pitches, or there would be a lot of pressure in a tennis game, I would try to control it. I would try to steer the baseball or aim my tennis shot. In basketball, if I was going for a layup with the game on the line, and it was just a layup, nobody was defending me, that was sometimes the hardest shot for me. I remember a putt. I used to play golf with my friends in tournaments all over Utah. And when I had like a 3-foot or a 4-foot putt, which is relatively easy, sometimes those are the hardest shots to make because we hold on, we grip it very tightly. We try to force it. We try to aim it. There's a book that was given to me by my school psychologist when I was a freshman in high school called The Inner Game of Tennis. And it talks about this, about practicing, but then letting go and trusting your swing. There's a great book that my son gave me. My son's a gifted artist, a phenomenally gifted artist. He does it for a living. It was called Art and Fear. And one of the stories from the two authors was one of them taught ceramics in a college. And there were two groups. He would take it at the beginning of the semester and separate the class randomly into two groups. And he would say, this group over here on the left, you can make as much pottery as you want, and you'll be graded on the amount of pottery. I will simply weigh it at the end of the semester, and you'll be graded on the amount of art you produce. This group over on the right, you only have to produce one piece. You only get to turn in one piece, and you'll be graded on that piece. And the author said, the great works by far were in the group that produced that produced just mass amounts of art. So fear and anxiety get in the way of creativity. They get in the way of art. They get in the way of tennis, right? I mean, a tiny bit of fear can be helpful, but a significant amount of it limits us. And so you still take active. You're just not trying to control it. You know, you say, here's my boundary. It might be wrong, but this is what I feel good about. That's the essence of it. You're going to evoke. I don't know if it's the magic bullet. I don't know if it's going to fix everything, but I can't do what I was doing before. I'm not willing to live the way we were living before. I'm not willing to support that, so you're going here. You let go of being right, of being assured that you're doing the perfect thing, and then you turn it over to the child. So it's kind of an emotional, psychological, spiritual relationship to the decision, not whether or not you make the decision. I haven't said this in a long time, but most permissive parents are controlling. In my first book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, I talk about control versus influence, and I say that, I explain that. Most permissive parents are controlling, and they try to coerce through emotional coercion to control the child. And strictness, this is important. There's not a correlation between strictness and control. You can be fairly strict but let go. And you can be very, very permissive and be very controlling. It is the way you think, talk, feel, react to the child that is the control. So you learn to trust your swing, to trust your throw. And if you've ever been in sports or played tennis or tried to do something creative, you know the truth of that. You know that the enemy of creativity is fear, which leads to control, which leads to a loss of resources. So that's what it's about. It's something that over time gets more and more clear. It's something that creeps up on all of us. But that's basically what it is. All right, looks like there are no new questions. Let me go through some. You can submit questions now. I'm going to go through upcoming announcements, and then I'll end with any live questions that have come in. We will be in the Bay Area on Wednesday, February 26th at the San Mateo Marriott from 7 to 9 p.m. In Portland, Oregon on Friday, March 6th, 6 to 7:30 p.m. at Muir Hall. And in Southern California, Sunday, April 5th from 4 to 7 in North Hollywood, Studio City. Please email or RSVP to Kaysha, K-A-Y-S-H-A at evoketherapy.com or for any questions. Our next parent workshop, we ask all parents to come to a workshop while their child is with us. Our next one is February 15th in Oregon. If you can combine this with a visit to see your child, check with your Evoke therapist and see if the timing is right. Then after that, it'll be in March, March 7th at Entrada, our Southern Utah program. Upcoming intensives. The February one is full. March is almost full. Like I said, maybe one participant spot left, last I checked. The next one after that is April 15th and then May 13th. I will be in England May 8th. That will fill up in advance. So if you are in the UK or you know somebody in the UK that you'd like to go, tell them to book it in advance. I'll book a second one if this one fills up. And it's a wonderful property about an hour and a half outside of London. And it's a wonderful cook who lives with us. It's a beautiful, beautiful setting. Finding You Too, the July 15th is almost full, maybe full. So obviously these are filling up. Like I said, if this is consistent, we'll open up a second Finding You per month. Customized intensives for couples, families, professionals, and individuals are also available. Email us at intensives@evoketherapy.com. Pursuits trips are a few days to a month-long individualized adventure trips for young adults or families. We ask all current parents to go to 6 12-step support groups, any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, or Families Anonymous. AdultChildren.org is a place you can go to learn if you grew up in an alcoholic or a toxic family. It can be a great program. Alateen is for teenagers. Refuge Recovery, I had another person really swearing how wonderful this was just the other night. Refugerecovery.org is an alternative to the 12 steps. It's a Buddhist inspired, less of an emphasis on a higher power. NAMI.org, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, have classes and resources in your local area for free. All of these broadcasts are available on your favorite podcast app. On an iPhone, use the podcast app. On Androids, use SoundCloud.com or your favorite podcast app. On Twitter and Instagram, you can find Evoke Therapy programs by using the handle @EvokeTherapy. And you can find the Evoke Intensives on Instagram by using the handle @EvokeTherapyIntensives. On Facebook, you can find us by searching Evoke Therapy Programs, or the Alumni Foundation on Facebook by searching Evoke Family Foundation, and the Evoke blog has new content each week. My books, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, and soon, on February 24th, The Audacity to Be You, are available on Amazon. Any other live questions that have come up? Looks like none have come in. I have a special time. I'm going to be doing my next one on Monday. It's going to be a review of The Dance of Connection by Harriet Lerner. That'll be this Monday, February 3rd at 5:30 p.m. Mountain Time. I'm heading out to a conference later that evening, so we're having it at a special time. 5:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, Monday, February 3rd, reviewing The Dance of Anger by Dr. Harriet Lerner. Look forward to doing that. Thanks for joining me tonight. Thank you for your questions. Like I say always, family, friends, siblings, parents of Evoke clients, thank you for, on behalf of your willingness to do your work. If you're not an Evoke client, because most of the people that are listening to these actually aren't, numbers-wise, just thank you for being willing to do your work and to focus on you. It's the biggest difference that you can make in the world. So thanks for joining us this evening. Take care, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.